This podcast is entitled Empathy is the New Love. It is a selection plus bonus material from Chapter 9, Empathy Application, Sex, Love, Rock and Roll, and Empathy of the book Empathy Lessons by Lou Augusta. Copyright Lou Augusta. The idea is that what people really want more than anything else is to be gotten for who they authentically are. People want empathy. People want to be responded to as a whole person. When person A responds to person B as a whole person, the empathy includes relatedness. Who one is as a possibility. The possibility of having fun. The possibility of contribution. The possibility of sexuality between consenting adults. It includes recognition and acknowledgement. Empathy builds the bridge between love and sexuality. You know how in the world of high fashion, gray is the new black? Well, empathy is the new love. And this is not an exclusive either-or choice. People still want to be loved too, just not quite as much as they want to be gotten empathically. People can get love from Hallmark cards or from the internet. There is really a glut in the market for this kind of love, and many issues remain with its quality. Like any mass product, the quality is questionable. Really fine love remains a scarce commodity in the final analysis. Empathy is a relatively even rarer capacity in the market, though, truth be told, it is common to every mother and newborn child, every business person with satisfied customers. It is common to every educational student-teacher encounter and common to every neighborly encounter in the community. The unbearable lightness of empathy. Empathy brings love to sexuality and sexuality to love. The empathy lesson regarding empathic sexual practices is to envision sex as ordering a pizza rather than keeping score in a game of sports. One person likes mushrooms and peppers. The other person likes bacon and cheese. Mix and match. Can you relate to it? Instead of getting on base and scoring, the partners agree on a menu of toppings to be included or not. Consider the possibilities of toppings. One or two toppings might be completely unacceptable to one or another partner and off the list. For example, salty anchovies are notoriously unpopular, but maybe you find a partner who likes them. We'll get one or two toppings you like, one or two toppings I like, and let the fun begin. Speaking personally, as a socially awkward young adult, many, many years ago, I was hungry for guidance on how to relate to women, which is always good for a laugh. Full disclosure, I was interested in relating to women because I wanted to discuss the great books. And what better way to do so than while naked in bed? Of course I was interested in sex, and I believe that developing my interpersonal skills in dating was more likely to lead to success in dating than organizing and launching an expeditionary raid on a neighboring community to kidnap eligible females. Okay, bad joke. Just kidding about the raid. If I have to explain the joke, it's not funny. Confused 17-year-old that I was, I bought and read Simone de Beauvoir, The Second Sex, in the astonishingly misguided notion that this book would help me understand women in a way that would enable me to be more successful in dating. You can see I was a tough case. This was like studying nuclear physics in order to learn how to build a campfire to roast a weenie. De Beauvoir's reflections on biology and her rich literary examples from Proust, Stendhal, Madame de Sal were most engaging, and her work was a penetrating introduction to the philosophy of existentialism. It was just that all of the women I was meeting at the time were not existentialists. and their eyes rolled backwards, not with ecstasy or passion, but with incomprehension when I brought up the subject. I needed somebody to tell me in a fatherly way, "Look at Louis. Most women like guys who are interested in them for who they are as a person and as for the things they like to do. They like a good sense of humor and kindness and consideration. Given you're the brainy type, you are probably going to have more dating success with smart, educated women than with those attracted to shopping and sports." Stuff like that. I also needed to learn when someone was trying to flirt with me and how to flirt back, albeit in a manly way, when I think of the lost opportunities because I did not even recognize that a young lady was interested in relating to the kind of breezy but brainy guy that I was, it is truly sobering. In the story of Animal Magnetism and Seduction by Milan Kundera, the unbearable lightness of being, also a major motion picture, he writes, quote, "What is flirtation? One might say that it is behavior leading another to believe that sexual intimacy is possible while preventing that possibility from becoming a certainty." End quote. I suffered from the unbearable lightness of empathy, which meant that I was so anxious around girls that I could not be fully present with the other person. A tough case indeed. To say that I needed to expand my empathy would be an understatement. Full disclosure, I had gone to an all-boys house school where the prevailing approach to mastering one's libido was to encourage all manner of high school sports activities. My approach, on the other hand, was to sign up for a fifth academic major so that I could get out of gym class. The coaches reminded me of the drill sergeant from Central Casting and my own dad, all of whom seemed inspired by boot camp as a pedagogical method. So studying an extra science seemed a small price to pay to avoid seemingly programmed humiliation of being picked dead last when competitive sports teams were being chosen. Though I had barely a clue and was without any plan, my approach did pay off indirectly in that it got me into the college of the University of Chicago. There, for the first time ever, I encountered a level playing field. In the matter of dating, many of the women were as socially awkward as I was. I fit in, albeit with a group of misfits. The prevailing devaluing joke, which I defensively note I did not hear until many years later, was that the squirrels on the park-like quadrangle campus were more aggressive than the boys, and as for the girls, well, courtesy requires that I edit those comments out. Ouch! No one escaped whipping. The emotional awkwardness. I fit right in. It worked. Further work was needed in engaging the unbearable lightness of empathy, being with the other person with nothing else added, shifting out of stuckness into the possibility of seeing myself as attractive to women, a chick magnet. The truth of this male chauvinist conceit is that women like guys who get who they are as a possibility. Women like guys who respond to them as a whole person and vice versa. Women are attracted to guys who appreciate that they have a consciousness, subjectivity, hopes and fears, a mind and a body, aspirations, enlivened with feelings, preferences, ideas, and empathy. At this point, an example of the intersection of love and empathy will be useful as to how empathy brings love to sexuality and vice versa. I choose as my paradigm case the movie Bull Durham. Bull Durham is one of my favorite Valentine's Day show of all time. It's a fine show for any season. This is because it succeeds in bringing together love and desire, affection and arousal, silly Valentine-style sentiment and sexual satisfaction. Also, it has a happy ending. It is not really about baseball, though you would not be crazy for thinking it is. A guilty pleasure, perhaps. However, much more than baseball, this movie demonstrates powerfully that empathy is the new love. As a footnote, for those listeners who may be international, Durham is a city in North Carolina in the States, and Bull Durham is a brand of chewing tobacco, which many ball players would chew before it was discovered it caused cancer of the mouth and throat, at which point the vast majority of players sensibly switched to bubble gum. In Bull Durham, the heroine, Annie Savoy, played by Susan Sarandon, explains that she believes in the Church of Baseball. There are 108 beads in a Catholic rosary and 108 stitches in a baseball. Can this be a coincidence? Annie chooses one guy, a baseball player with whom to consort, that is, hook up, during each minor league baseball season. The film is set in the minor leagues. Suffice to say, it makes a good adolescent fantasy. The two top hookup candidates are Nuke LaLouche and Crash Davis, the latter played by Kevin Costner. Nuke is played by Tim Robbins. Crash is a talented catcher who never broke out from the minor leagues. Crash is given an extension and asked to play for one more season to bring along Ebby Calvin LaLouche, who, it seems, is destined for greatness and for the major leagues, the show, as it is called. Nicknamed Nuke LaLouche for his powerful fastball, Nuke lacks control, and his 90-mile-an-hour pitch is depicted as beaning the Big Bird-type mascot of the opposing team. Down it goes. Funny. The nickname Nuke LaLouche expresses an empathic understanding of who the person is and induces a vicarious experience with which the person leaves the viewer. Powerful like nuclear energy, but perhaps more than a tad out of control and about to blow up. Crash asks Annie, why do you get to pick, before making her choice of LaLouche over Crash? Annie's answer nicely outlines a position close to mine about empathy is the new love, if one includes that Annie is actually choosing. Quote, well, actually, nobody on this planet ever really chooses each other. I mean, it's all a question of quantum physics, molecular attraction, and timing. Why, there are laws we don't understand that bring us together and tear us apart. It's like pheromones. You get three ants together, they can't do dick. You get 300 million of them, they can build a cathedral. End quote. There's something for everyone in this film. Suffice to say, Nuke desires any woman he can get his hands on. He is a real Lil Abner type. Muscular, ripped, built, but perhaps lacking between the ears. He does definitely not have the distinction desire of desire, and women are as opaque to him as he is opaque, period. Annie provides the empathy lessons. Nuke lets himself be tied up by her, tightly, as he's a big fella, in anticipation of a sexual adventure. And she paints his toenails. Nuke doesn't really get it, but he kind of likes it. This puts a certain spin, more like a slider than a fastball, on female empowerment. The lesson includes learning to wait. Presumably, Nuke's fastball gets more controlled along with his bedside manner. For Crash, the empathy lesson is that Annie is the ultimate unattainable object. Annie plays hard to get in the most authentic possible way. She freely withholds her desire, even though one suspects the desire lives in her. Crash knows he's desirable. Hey, he looks just like Kevin Costner. But Annie won't give in, and unless she does so freely, voluntarily, it may be a power trip or a notch on someone's pistole, but it's not authentic sexual satisfaction. It's barely even sex. In addition, Crash's challenge is that he has standards. Yes, he desires Annie, but more than that, he desires her desire, which, unless freely given, just does not get the sexual satisfaction job done for him. When asked what he believes, Crash gives one of the great soliloquies on empathic love. Quote, "Well, I believe in the soul, the small of a woman's back, the hanging curveball, high fiber, good scotch, that the novels of Susan Sontag are self-indulgent, overrated crap. I believe Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone. I believe there ought to be a constitutional amendment outlawing AstroTurf and the designated hitter. I believe in the sweet spot, soft core pornography, opening your presents Christmas morning rather than Christmas Eve, and I believe in long, slow, deep, soft, wet kisses that last 3 days." End quote. Such kisses require empathy. Crash is frustrated in his desire because he longs to unite his desire with his affection for Annie and receive hers and her desire in return. I tell you, you cannot get this movie without the distinction desire of desire, which it so eloquently exemplifies. So when Crash does finally unite desire and affection in uniting with Annie and her desire of his desire, it makes for a happy ending. Everyone in the film reconciles desire and affection, and Nuke gets control over premature ejaculation. Oops, I mean his fastball. If empathy is the new love, what then was the old love? A bold statement of the obvious. The old love is akin to a kind of madness. The one who is in love is hypnotically held in bonds by an idealization of the beloved. In one way, love presents as animal magnetism, a powerful attraction. In another way, in a quasi-hypnotic trance, love idealizes the beloved and overlooks the would-be partner's shortcomings and limitations. For example, according to Nobel Prize-winning novelist Gabriel Garcia Marquez, love is akin to a physical illness, cholera. In Marquez's novel, Love in the Time of Cholera, also a major motion picture, the mother of Florentino Ariza treats her son's love sickness for the inaccessible Fermina Daza with the kind of natural herbs used to relieve the diarrhea of cholera. Key term, inaccessible. The inaccessible object, whether the mother who is already married to the father or the girl next door whose family is feuding with one's own, arouses one's desire to a fever pitch. The inaccessible object, I repeat, arouses one's desire to a fever pitch. Note that in English and Spanish, cholera and choleric, respectively, denote an emotional upset, expressing irritability and a kind of manic rage, hooking up, as it does in this instance, with Plato's definition of love as madness. In a diverging register on the other tradition, in St. Paul, for example, love literally is God. Love is community, and love is neighborliness. Furthermore, another example, according to Bob Dylan, now also a Nobel Prize winner, quote, love is just another four-letter word, end quote. No sublimation here, just hormones all the way down, though, to Dylan's credit, he did not claim or publish the song as his own after Joan Baez made it famous. According to Freud, moving right along, love is aim-inhibited sexuality, When sexual desire is unable to attain its goal, which by definition is sexual satisfaction, the desire undergoes a transformation. The desire turns away from reality and expresses itself in fantasy. The desire becomes articulate. The desire learns to speak. It expresses symbolic statements of romantic dalliance, music, and even love poetry. It lives on in the hope of recovering the erotic dimension. For example, in the theatrical play Cyrano de Bergerac, the heroine Roxanne, also the name of a major motion picture Roxanne, Roxanne invites one of her suitors, a man named Christian, to mount up the balcony to get a kiss. Meanwhile, another one of her interested suitors, Cyrano of the title, is writing love poetry for his friend Christian to help him woo Roxanne. Cyrano is in love, and his love makes him blind, as in the stereotype, blind to the spoiled princess-like behavior of Roxanne and blind to the arrogant narcissism of his so-called friend Christian. Meanwhile, that celebrated Athenian bad boy, Socrates, remember him from the ancient Greeks? Bad boy Socrates famously says, "I know that I know nothing." But then it turns out that he did know something after all, though only as a kind of myth. But what kind of knowledge is a myth? And Socrates distinguishes four kinds of madness, the last one of which is love. Quote, "And we made four divisions of divine madness according to four gods. To Apollo we ascribed prophetic inspiration, to Dionysius mystic madness, to the Muses poetic expression, while to Aphrodite and Eros we gave the fourth, love madness, declaring it to be the best of all." End quote. In another Platonic dialogue called the Symposium, Socrates and his friends, who are basically drinking partners, are having a drunken party, as told by Plato. And at this party, there are some A-listers, the humorist and playwright, satirical playwright, Aristophanes shows up, and they all agree to have a contest telling stories about how love really came into the world. Aristophanes says, originally, human beings were these spherical beings, each having four arms and four legs, and instead of walking, human beings rolled around spherically. So we would roll around and kind of just bounce off of one another. But, as usually happens in myths, pride goeth before the fall. Human beings are prideful, and due to a sin of pride, the gods punished these original spherical human beings by dividing them into two. This results in our current present-day predicament of separated halves of the original spherical beings. These halves are called male and female, and they actually are male and female, human beings as we now know them today. The two halves are incomplete. Each wants to be reunited and completed by the other half. We speculate that the division into male and female is not the only division. The separation of desire and affection is also a source of struggle, but about that, Aristophanes has nothing to say. Meanwhile, in summary, the old love is a kind of madness. It makes a person blind. It causes somatic distress. So far, the old love is indistinguishable from tertiary syphilis. Let us be clear. No one is proposing an either-or choice between love and empathy. These two phenomena have existed and coexisted since the beginning and will continue to do so. My proposal is that love contains an empathic core in its stimulating and exciting aspects, and that which is the lovesickness part is due, well, to the struggle to unite affection and desire. In particular, that which is the lovesickness is due to a breakdown in empathy. The goal in love is to erase, at least temporarily, the boundary between self and other, between lover and beloved. Merger of both mind and body with the other mind and body is the result. In contrast to love, empathy navigates or crosses or transgresses the boundary between self and other, such that the integrity of the self and other are maintained. One has a vicarious experience of the other, but the difference and integrity of the self and other are maintained. So love emerges as a breakdown in empathy from the perspective of too much or too little engagement with the other. It is love versus empathy, yet in love, empathy lives. In the examples of Annie and Crash Davis, the example of love madness described by Socrates, the example of the connection in Aristophanes between the spherical halves, the attraction is a kind of magnetism, animal magnetism to be precise. In attraction jeopardy, animal magnetism is the answer. What then is the question? How does a vicarious experience of someone else's desire show up? Question mark. A desire of desire? Question mark. If we let our empathic receptivity inform our experience, stage one of intersection of empathy and love can be redescribed as animal magnetism. Simply stated, such animal magnetism is what you get when two lovers stare semi-hypnotically into one another's eyes. Speaking from the guy perspective, to really turn on a woman, a guy has to get in touch with his inner female. He does not have to tell his softball buddies about this, but in the language of the Kama Sutra, such a guy turns out to be worth his weight in diamonds. This is especially so if he sees value in getting in touch with his inner female by practicing cooking and even down the line, changing some diapers. When empathic receptivity shows up, can empathic understanding be far away? In this case, the empathic possibilities are rich and rewarding. But since this is not a book on sex tips and techniques, the reader or listener are referred to further literature such as Alex Comfort, MD, and The Joy of Sex. Same idea with empathic interpretation, in which role-playing is a significant opportunity. We feel chemistry with some people and not with others because our empathic receptivities, understanding, and responses are aligned. We are able to fit the other person into the narrative we tell ourselves, a little bit like the two halves of the spherical being, about what we are seeking in a partner. The other person fits into our imagination and a role we design and assign imaginatively, and the person is a good enough fit that they are willing and able to play the role assigned. Notice this means that the love part is the aspect that is the most problematic. If she gets it that he is good boyfriend material, he has a nurturing side that will make him, for example, a good father, but this turns out not to be accurate because he is a spoiled child himself, then it was love's idealizations and wishful thinking, a breakdown of empathy into projection, the blindness of love makes one blind, not authentic empathy. On the other hand, if the initial empathy is accurate, it paves the way for love and empathy to enhance each other mutually in creating the community called a family. The empathy lesson is that people are sometimes what they appear to be, but that sometimes appearances are misleading. This explains the common sense lesson that you need to talk to somebody and listen to them before making serious, significant commitments of the heart or even of finances. People come in all different shapes and sizes. Aristophanes' joke gets the last word and lives on because the original spherical beings were themselves in all different shapes and sizes before they were cleaved in two. People complete one another in different ways. In conclusion, after all the categories, labels, evaluations, assessments, diagnoses, arguments, and projections are removed, empathy is being in the presence of the other spherical being without anything else added.